Ken Burns, as you know, has a way of telling stories the way we will remember them. So we have to watch and listen carefully. I think especially of a moment, I think it was the baseball series, when Gerald Early just turned to the camera as if he'd just thought of something. And he said, you know, this society will be remembered for three things: the U.S. Constitution, jazz, and baseball. And I'm always impressed by people who can come to three main points about anything, but I often sort of reorient myself with that line. I mean, who are we? What's going on here? U.S. Constitution, jazz, and baseball. And it's so true. This story of World War II is a story the way we'll remember it. This kind of good guy country, the melting pot going to war. Amazing how many of the people in that movie look like Frank Sinatra and Burt Lancaster. It's a spectacle of places going to war, the way Ken and his team have told it. And I'd like really to begin there. As you know from the movie, it was a country more than it is today of sharply defined provincial colors. I love the Connecticut part, but there's a sort of machine tool town in New England, which on a European map would be almost a different country from the old slave port of Mobile, Alabama. It has echoes in Iraq in a certain way in National Guard regiments going from Mississippi or New Hampshire, and I'm sure you know the War Tapes movie there. What's changed? And also, why did you begin with that as a narrative device?
It's interesting. We accidentally kind of came to it. We knew that this was going to be the first film in which we were taking a subject that had been done to death. There are thousands of World War II books and thousands of World War II documentaries, and the world didn't really need another one in the same ilk. And yet we felt compelled to do it. We were losing too many veterans. Our kids think we fought with the Germans against the Russians in the Second World War. There were a number of compelling reasons to treat it. And strangely enough, we've made a documentary in which it's the first time of all those thousands of documentaries in which the European and the Pacific theaters happen at the same time. Seems sort of obvious. That's the way it went. But the simultaneity really adds to it. And as I began to see that I wanted to tell it in that way, the only way to do it was to anchor it utterly in bottom-up. So I'm just following the choices that we made. That is to say, you'd have no focus on the top-down leaders. It had to be entirely bottom-up. There'd be nobody in our film that was an expert, a Monday morning quarterback or armchair historian. It would just be so-called ordinary people that do it. I thought perhaps, or actually a colleague of mine, Dayton Duncan, who didn't work on this film except as a consultant, he and I are working on another project right now, said, well, why don't you do it with one town? And because I knew that I wanted to pick a place that had no associations for not only my audience, but for me, we picked Waterbury, Connecticut. Because we'd heard a lot about it. We drove past it all the time. It seemed mysterious. And then we learned that they had really carefully saved their archives. And we went there and almost immediately realized we weren't going to bump into enough veterans with enough range of combat experience. And at that point, we said, what if we just branch out and, like darts on a map or tent stakes, tying down the country, Waterbury, Mobile, Sacramento, Laverne, pick towns that would give us the regional sort of differences necessary. And then that relationship to place, to geography, was throughout the film. The only way you can understand simultaneously a war happening is if you're holding metaphorically the front page of that newspaper and you know that you've got friends that are over there and over there and over there and over there. And so we as I was just saying to you a second ago, early on gave the addresses of people. You knew that somebody lives in Main Street or North Estes Street or 1055 Monterey Place or on Royal Street on the other side of the railroad tracks, and you get a sense of where people are. We all remember what our address was when we were 18 years old. And if we can't remember it, the last place, we know that one. And so we fixed it in that way.
You bring up a tender point, or that I felt I had to be tender about, which is that we've heard this story many, many, many times, and not just Studs Terkel's
The Good War.
Good War and Brokaw's Greatest Generation and Saving Private Ryan. But going back, when my brothers and I coined our phrase about the melting pot going to war, we were watching Stalag 17.
Right.
And so many of these movies, like yours, are the same. There's always a black guy. There's always an Irish guy. There's always an Italian guy. There's a Jewish guy. There's all this mix of...
The bomber crew.
The bomber crew, the guy whose girlfriend is wavering back home. Why do we have to hear it again?
Yeah,
I mean, seriously.
No, absolutely. And we just did not want to do it. After the Civil War, I've probably got a file of thousands of letters from people telling me what my next project would be, and I'm sure 75% of them were about World War II. And each time I very politely said, no, we don't really need the same thing because this war has been so covered with barnacles, so encrusted, so smothered with that bloodless gallant myth, that idea of the melting pot going to war. And it's a much more complicated thing. And what happens, we see it in every war, in situations. First of all, the human breast gets very excited about going to war. They actually do. They forget. At the Civil War, they rode out in their carriages with their picnic baskets, and they were going to see this, you know, what? A spectator sport? This is going to be fun to look at? That's what they thought. They were going to sit on the hill and watch, you know, what? And so we forget that reality, that cost of it. And as we recede and distance from it, the Civil War is another good example. It was no longer about the liberation of 4 million American citizens and, most importantly, their descendants from bondage. Oh, no, it was some strange arguments about states' rights and nullification and secession, which we really worked out, and now we're one country again. And so the Second World War has itself acquired this baggage of us not knowing. And most of all, besides this simultaneity thing, or the difference between stuff that showed context or intimacy, and we wanted to try to show context through intimacy, that's the bottom-up idea, is that everything was mitigated by an interest in generals and politicians who don't do the fighting and dying, by strategy and tactics, which abstract what is the cost of war, which is human beings dying. And or they were obsessed, as the Hitler Channel, the History Channel is, with guns and armaments and weaponry. And more important, they call it the Hitler Channel because there is a very understandable interest in evil. And so we throw ourselves open to the susceptibility of that swastika and that ugly little mustache on that small man. And we sort of love to hate the evilness of it, but that also metastasizes, if you watch these things, into a kind of admiration for their early military successes, for their industrial superiority, for their better weapons, and that I can't abide by. And what we decided to do was just clear out all that junk and ask, would it be possible to bear witness to what people, many of whom have not spoken before, bear witness to the experience of battle for the first time and make a different kind of film?
What intrigues me, I must say, is our own obsession as watchers, I'm one of them, in feeling good. And I want to say, first of all, that there's nothing simple about your movie. You deal with evil. You deal with American evil. You deal with troops who remember killing their Japanese prisoners. You talk about, Sam Hines talks about why people joined. He said patriotism had nothing to do with it. It was just the boredom of Minnesota. There's a terrific ambiguity in your thing. Also about the fact that war, as a geostrategic exercise, was great for this country. We came out of it the industrial power in the world. So I don't want to suggest that there's anything simple-minded about your take. At the same time, it does seem to feed this insatiable need of us Americans
to celebrate,
to see ourselves as
the saviors,
G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
Even in the middle of a longer war than that in Iraq, about which we desperately worry that we've squandered our moral advantage in the world, maybe forever.
We have definitely done that here. I don't know about forever. I'm a little bit more optimistic, I hope, about that.
So
but
am
I. But the second you know, this was our frustration with how the Second World War has been covered, and what we wanted to do was not do that, to be that complex, to have that undertow, to talk about the home front and the saving of bacon fat and the milkweed pods and the, you know, the scrap metal, but understand, too, that one quarter of every transaction, it was estimated, was part of a black market. That you could still celebrate whatever common spirit there was, and there was, but still understand that there were people who hated Roosevelt. That we weren't all. It was the same as today. We just didn't have this ridiculous media apparatus that makes the smallest little cut into a mortal wound, that makes the slightest political difference into the difference between patriotism and treason, and that there was a sense of shared sacrifice that paradoxically made us all richer.
Okay, I want to ask you a trivia question and then the sort of the essay question. The trivia question, and I'm sure you know it much better than I, but this is for everybody. What's the ratio of Russian dead in World War II to American dead in World War II? Ken, I'm sure you know.
It's close to 50 to 1.
Yep. John Gaddis said it was, in fact, considering all the Eastern Front, 90 to 1.
90 to 1, probably.
Again, why do we have to see it? Why did you choose to see it as an American war?
That, I think, is a good question. I'm an American. I tell stories in American history. That's what I've done. I found my work, as provincial and parochial as that might be, that's who I am. It, you know, you could say to Cézanne, Monsieur, I notice you keep painting the same mountain over and over again. Aren't there Alps and Rockies and Himalayas and others, but this Mount Saint-Victoire you keep doing over and over again? And he would say, yes, but I'm still working out questions about it. If we had tried to be ecumenical, I mean, each time, each episode, we rise up two or three times to give a kind of perspective of what's going on and acknowledge the unspeakable slaughter. We wanted to provide access. So you can imagine my surprise when earlier this year the Cannes Film Festival called up and said, we want to show the war. And I said, oh, that's great. Which episode? And he said, all of it. And I thought, they're crazy. And so we went off to Cannes and terrified, quaking in our boots. And they showed it, and if you didn't need to eat or go to the bathroom, it was a perfectly reasonable, you know, nearly 15 hours straight screening. And people stayed, and they watched, and it was this international crowd. And I went up sort of afterwards, a kind of apologetic to the 50 or 60 odd people who had made it through every single episode. And literally, it was difficult to go to the bathroom between episodes. You could eat, you couldn't eat, but you could conceivably go to the bathroom. I said, but this is such from an American point of view. And they said, but this is universal human themes. I recognize every, and that's what we hoped, that you could take a Blakean sense, that you could find the world in a grain of sand. And that's what we did. I happen to be American. I happen to be interested in how my country works. So I took American grains of sand. But what we were after was a human aspect of the war, and the response at Cannes sort of proved it. It wasn't possible. You didn't need to do it. It would be better for a Russian to tell that story. And in fact, there was a Russian there and said, I need to make this film for my country.
Forgive me, Ken. I just have to push you a little bit, because that kind of solipsism, us, you know, alone in the universe, or focus on ourselves, becomes after a while, I think, in a global world where you know, half of the 6 billion of us are hungry, and some are desperately oppressed, it begins to seem part of the problem.
Yeah.
That we can't see around our own sentiment.
If I were to have done, say, arbitrarily taken, you can't do, not even World of War could do it, take several different perspectives. In fact, The World at War, the, a couple generations ago, sort of long-form series on the Second World War, was its creakiest when it was attempting to be all things to all people. You can't do that. We were insisting that you could take one particular point of view. You're absolutely right. If we had approached it the way the other documentaries had approached it, but we insisted on that complexity. We insisted on having the undertow that I think was necessary to not only suggest that universality, but to undermine this myth of American exceptionalism, to undermine that myopic view that we are the saviors and the liberators of the world. We made it pretty clear in every episode what the action was, that for me, it was less important to rehash again all of those old strategic things or the moral things or the easily abstracted moments. Roosevelt knew that Pearl Harbor was coming and he let it happen. Or we knew about the Holocaust and we turned away ships and we could have done this. Or the bomb didn't need to be dropped and if we'd only done this. All taken out of context. I said, what if you actually experienced the war as people experienced it, just getting the headlines if you were back home, lucky enough to be back home, or if you weren't lucky enough to be back home, what was it actually like to turn away and suddenly come back and find my closest buddies' brains are all over there? And who do you tell? What kind of story? And we know that that's what's happened because most of these people went off to war, our fathers and our grandfathers, and they have not spoken about it. And in this tiny little window, they are, some of them, a small fraction of them, 1/90th perhaps of them, are beginning to tell some stories. And I sat as a documentary filmmaker doing it. Yes, we still shoot on film, so every 12 minutes we change the magazine, and heard a son say, "Pop, you never told us that before." And I thought, oh my God, I'm here at the birth of expressed memory. That this guy has sat there and he's been angry. I got an email today from someone who had written a column in some paper saying, a letter I never sent to me, essentially saying that she just spent all night sobbing. Her father, who had recently died, was suddenly present with her watching, and she had repaired and fixed all of the stuff that had happened in a one-sided fashion. It was that spiritual and psychological war we're after. I'm happy to argue and debate about Russian stuff and strategic stuff and all of that, but what I wanted to get at was a kind of street-level view. What is it actually like in this war so that we don't ever refer to it as the good war again? This was the worst war ever.
I think Studs Terkel agrees with you, and he wonders why he called it the Good War.
Yes, and Studs has been a friend. He's been a voice in our film, and you know, his was, I think now in retrospect, he's anxious about it, but at the time he was going this,
right,
Good War, and he understood, and I think we all understand what it is, particularly as the decades recede and we find ourselves continually involved in wars that are ambivalent at best or that engage more than a majority of the population in opposition, as certainly Vietnam and the current, you know, ridiculousness is, it's very easy to fall back into that thing that this was a good war because at least we were more or less unanimous. The causes seemed just. It was, as we put it, a necessary war.
Even that's arguable, but I want to come back to my essay question, which is, if we're determined to see it whole, but to sort of snap our heads out of sentimentality, and then imagine that it's not just nostalgia or self-love that brings us to this fascination. If we're trying to imagine that the beauty and the sacrifice, the manliness, the home front devotion, all of that stuff were real, mm-hmm, and as rare and as precious as the film suggests, then what? Where did we lose it, if we did, and how do we get it back as a real thing? If we're studying this not just as an obsession, but as a kind of example to our best selves.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think we lost it right away. I was at the Telluride Film Festival and I saw a documentary on Klaus Barbie, And the shame that I felt at our almost instantaneous capitulation to the Cold War mentality, the ability to forgive Nazi crimes in order to get them on our side and not the Russian, the winking at certain things, and then, as we know, the CIA and the Eisenhower's military industrial complex that has overtaken and really chewed us up, where in tandem with a consumer society, which is absolutely certain that if we just buy the right things, everything will be all right. All of these things have conspired to do this. I'm still engaged in history, and history is not just rehashing abstractly the events and dates of the past, but is the set of questions we in the present ask of the past. And so it is informed by our desires, our wishes, our curiosities, our profound disgust and anxiety, as I think you're speaking here. So I know we lost it. Our film, I have to say, was begun before 9/11. Most of the interviews were done, recorded before the invasion of Iraq. So when Sam Hinds looks in the second bite of the film and says, there's no such thing as a good war, there are only necessary wars, that then gives our episode one its title, this is before Iraq. But everybody knows. When Sam Hinds later on in Saipan says, we knew about the brutality of the Japanese with regard to our prisoners, and we were certain that we weren't capable of that. He said, although I don't know what Americans would do in the same situation. And he said this well before we invaded Iraq, well before Abu Ghraib. But I defy anyone here watching that scene not to have thought of Abu Ghraib at that moment. And that's exactly what history does. And I think what you're talking about, and I'd like to go back to two words you use that are very important, which is nostalgia and sentimentality. Okay. They are the enemies of good everything. The enemies. And yet, you need to risk an emotional sophistication, which is what I've been interested in. I've been interested in an emotional archaeology. Too often, in our acknowledgement of the sand trap, that the quicksand that is nostalgia and sentimentality, resort to the safety of a kind of rational, empirical world in which we're able to parse and dissect and clearly compartmentalize the things that, in opposition to nostalgia and sentimentality, distract us and upset us. But we also fail to acknowledge that the things that animate our inner lives and our outer concerns and desires and wishes are themselves rooted in a higher emotional state that is totally free of sentimentality and nostalgia, but nonetheless, at some point, resembles it, or at least gives shadows to the person who is a less attentive watcher. I mean, places like this are built out of higher emotional commitment. The work that you're proudest of, the relationships that you value, the people that you love are based on those associations of a higher thing, and yet we still resort to a kind of empirical or rational set of constructs to help us explain, to superimpose a certain order on the inevitable chaos. Art does that. Narrative does that, and I am involved in an art form that mostly is engaged in narrative, telling of stories. And so what we're all doing is, in essence, holding the wolf at the door at bay, the wolf of chaos, the wolf of total nihilistic darkness. Mm. And we construct our religions. We say there is this thing called love. We do actually feel higher emotional things. We find sustaining energy in art and in literature and in the intellect that rises beyond the intellect's ability to articulate it. Music is a perfect example. Music seems indescribable, and it is. And we think it's the failure of music, and it's not. It's the failure of words to describe it. So I have spent most of my professional life trying to figure out an emotional sophistication of these things that actually not only jettisons nostalgia and sentimentality, though it at times resembles or is a cousin of it, but also rejects the pure empirical or rational explanation for what's going on. And that is a really tough thing to live with in the editing room and the conceptual moments of the film, even after it's done, particularly in a film like this.
I think that's a great essay in response to my essay question. Thank you. That's serious thinking. You mentioned music. I guess what I'm driving at is that, for me, the nostalgia in your movie, I keep saying to myself, no, it's not nostalgia. It's real. The music, by God, every time In a Sentimental Mood and the Ellington Band, or Basie, 1 o'clock Jump, or Glenn Miller for that matter, comes in, I think, wow, the music was better. This was, and not only, I mean, this is eternal music. This is,
yes, it is
as great as Schubert. This is as good as it gets. Also, from the sublime to the ridiculous, a fashion note. The guys look so good. They wore so much less. We were a skinnier country in those days.
You can get the answer to both your questions from jazz musicians today who talk about being clean and looking sharp and things like that. And we have sort of dissipated. You know, we now come in with our blue jeans and our T-shirts and our shorts, and we're perfectly, we think we're liberated by being free to wear whatever we want. And a jazz musician, as you see, often reminds you that the discipline of form actually is a rigorous expression.
Winton will tell you that.
Yeah.
They're on time. But I want to come back to this question of how, with a very refined sensibility, you're trying to work this balance in the movie between feeling great about G.I. Joe, and also with a 21st century sensibility, that we're certainly facing the danger of becoming that kind of Martian-dressed imperial monster that we dread so much.
That's right. I know what you're after, and I can't actually give you the answer. I can tell you that what we were trying to do was not throw the baby out with the bathwater. It is so simple to be revisionist, to say this was all bad in the face of our current situation and our own revulsion to the myth of exceptionalism. It is possible to go back and understand guilelessness. It is possible not to react in an ironic age with
Amen.
Irony,
Amen.
That what I am, and unabashedly so, is unironic, knowing full well that within an unironic stance it is possible to appreciate irony. But an ironic stance does not know itself or the opposite. It is only hip and edgy and ironic. It is a Mobius strip that goes nowhere. And so if you wish to risk the blessing, you also have to risk sentimentality and nostalgia. You have to risk the dissatisfaction of not being able to have things neatly resolved. Because what irony does is say, nothing's going to be resolved, so let me resolve it by being disinterested in what it is all about anyway. Huh, is the war cry of irony. I cannot be that. And yet, within an unironic life, art, posture within a particular film, it is possible to parse excruciating irony, as this film does throughout.
Well said. And I want to be just clear on the record. I see real virtue in that period in our country.
Yes.
And real beauty, especially in the music, but in the manhood, in the whole story. Ken Burns, I'd love to know what the response to you is from these movies, letters, emails, phone calls. What I hear, especially from the veteran generation and their families, is just kind of huge gratitude and affection and respect. In the media world, of course, everybody just kind of marvels at your skill. I mean, if only Homer had could edit film and sound
Simpson
the way
you're
do.
Talking about now.
Among the younger generation, I'm very puzzled, and a lot of the people I count on for tips haven't seen the series. But what are you hearing?
Well, you know, I thought that my life totally changed when the Civil War series came out, and part of that change was the way in which people started to have a conversation with me that I think they already felt they'd been having by virtue of spending 11 and a half hours watching that series. It was immensely satisfying, professionally and emotionally in every way. And I thought that was in some ways a sort of high point. It has not even come close to what's happened in the last few weeks. Veterans have come up and, you know, weeping, have said, I've waited all my life for someone to show it the way it was. And what I feared is that no one would really see the opening disclaimer in front of not just the film, but early on in the editing, I insisted that it go in front of every episode. The Second World War was fought in thousands of places, too many for anyone accounting. This is the story of four American towns and how their citizens experienced that war. I would get, as I did in Civil War, as I got in baseball, as I got in jazz, this is what you've left out. You didn't tell my story. How come you didn't do submariners? Why didn't you do this? And that has been so few and far between compared to Civil War, baseball, and jazz, and other films that we've done, that I think that what this emotional archaeology that I've described actually took place, and that people found themselves in the battles. I mean, we, editing it, had our own kind of sort of platonic, that is to say, one generation removed, shadow on a cave version of PTSD. It was just impossible to dig through these archives and look at thousands of hours of footage and tens of thousands of photographs and not be warped emotionally by what we saw and having to choose. And I remember a middle-aged woman came into our editing room and we showed over 3.5 days the whole series to about 40 or 50 people, including teenagers, 20-somethings and 30-somethings. She just said, "It's horrible. Do not take out a single dead body."
You remind me, speaking of things that get left out, all I really wanted to ask you is, why wasn't Errol Garner in the jazz series?
That Errol Garner was like, I think, number two or number three on our list of, you know, shame. I have one very quick story and aside, which is I was making a film on Frank Lloyd Wright after baseball came out, and I was in Racine, Wisconsin, the site of his magnificent Johnson Wax building, Wright's Johnson Wax building. I was being given a personal tour of it, and the woman was very happy to show me this large storage area that had been converted into a gym, an adaptive reuse. I'm sure Wright would have probably frowned on, but nonetheless, she was very proud of it. It was a beautiful May day. No one in their right mind should have been exercising indoors, but here was a guy furiously pedaling, like the Wicked Witch of the West, a stationary bike, and we were passing through this room, going catty-corner from one entrance to another, and as I went by, the guy goes, "My brother hates you." And I'm thinking, this guy doesn't have a brother, you know. He hates me. So I looked at him and I said, "Baseball." And he goes, "Yeah, how did you know?" And so I think, I'm in Racine, Wisconsin, you know, where am I? And I said, "Harmon Killebrew." And he goes, "Yeah, Harmon Killebrew," you know, somebody who we didn't do justice to his career. And I love the fact, though, that after working on films that are 18 and a half hours, as baseball is, 17 and a half as jazz is, 15 as the war is, 14 as the West is, and 11 and a half as the Civil War, the single greatest complaint is what you left out. You know, to me, as a filmmaker, that's...
Ken Burns, I mean, this is an old problem, but I'm more and more drawn to William James and his essay, "The Moral Equivalent of War." He was such a sophisticated post-Darwinian psychologist. He knew that the violence is in us.
Yes.
And he also called himself a radical pacifist. But he said, and I address this to Ken, in great admiration, what do we do with, God knows, your contemplation of this reality? What William James said, among other things, early in this essay, "Modern man inherits all the innate pugnacity and all the love of glory of his ancestors. Showing war's irrationality and horror is of no effect on him. The horrors make the fascination. War is the strong life. It is life in extremis. War taxes are the only ones men never hesitate to pay, as the budgets of all nations show." And he goes on from there. But Ken, last word, what do we do with this unbelievable surfeit of knowledge of ourselves, our glory, our violence, our American opportunity, and also this war instinct?
This is not an American question. It's a human question, first of all. So we'll strip it away from nationality. It is absolutely right what was said. There is something that takes place in war, which is life lived at its fullest. And that's the paradox. when your life is most threatened. We're sitting here. Does anyone fear for their life at this moment? If we were in war right now, a shell could come crashing through here and kill half of us in 1 millisecond. And we live our lives at a heightened state of experience that is also attractive and compelling, and may be one of the reasons why we are drawn to paradox. That quote is essentially, the glass is half empty. It's like Sontag's essay on photography, that the act of photography is, if I take your picture, I'm appropriating something from you, and does not acknowledge the possibility of human equation in which, in order to take your photograph, I give something back to you. So the equivalent to that quote is that we do acknowledge this paradox of war. It is, you know, absolutely frustrating in that it is compelling as well as horrific. But we can arm ourselves with the danger. By that, you would give up and not paint Guernica. You would not show what it was like because it wouldn't work. But in fact, that's a good thing. So let us not stop bearing witness to what takes place. Let us not stop organizing that material into some coherent narrative that suggests the possibility that we might mitigate or check that natural, seemingly natural inclination towards the bellicose, towards the pugnacious that is referred to. And that's, I'm sorry to say, in some ways, the best we can hope for.
Ken Burns, thank you enormously for this evening.
Thank you. It's great.